Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. I live in Arizona in the Sonoran Desert, and I have to admit that sometimes I get tired of living in this dry, hot climate. And then winter comes and I'm convinced that I live in paradise. But it's the dry climate of the Southwest that has given us the tremendous gift of the past by preserving ancient cultural sites. From Mesa Verde in Colorado to Chaco Canyon in New Mexico to Casa Grande ruins and Montezuma's castle in Arizona to petroglyphs across hundreds and hundreds of miles of this region, we can get a glimpse into the lives of the people who lived here 1,000 years ago. In this episode, Ranger Austin Tumas joins me from Hovenweep National Monument to talk about the ancient Pueblo people who once lived there and the remarkable archaeoastronomy they left behind. And if you don't know what archaeoastronomy is, Austin is going to define it for us. Since Hovenweep is in a remote, although easy-to-reach location, our first attempt at this interview was derailed by a power outage. It's the summer monsoon season in the American Southwest right now, and the storms made connecting for this interview a little bit tricky. So we resorted to Austin joining with her smartphone. And as you're about to find out, it was well worth our persistence to connect for this interview. Austin's passion for Hovenweep and its deep connection to the cosmos is going to inspire you to plan a trip there as it did for me. Austin started working for the National Park Service 7 years ago as a college student. And since then, she's worked in 8 different parks across the country. Astronomy was part of the activities at 6 of those parks. And although her degree is in anthropology, she learned a great deal about astronomy during her first season at Hovenweep, proving that anyone can learn the night sky. Austin has worked at Hovenweep as a seasonal interpretation ranger, as a student conservation intern, with the Volunteer in Parks program, and now as a permanent ranger, as a lead interpreter. And when I asked Austin for her bio, I love that she included her favorite constellation, which she says is Scorpius, because it's easy to find, it's easy to imagine the scorpion, and it takes up so much of the sky. Please join me tonight in welcoming to the podcast, Ranger Austin Tumas. Austin, thank you so much for joining me on the Night Sky Tours podcast. I'm so excited to have you here to talk about a place that I think most people don't even know about.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I love talking about the night sky, and especially love talking about the night sky at these kind of smaller remote national monuments like Hovenweep.
So let's start by having you share with everybody, where is Hovenweep and what does the name mean?
Ooh, good question. So Hovenweep is a really small national monument that sits straddling the border between Utah and Colorado, very close to the actual Four Corners themselves. So we're in the Four Corners region, but we're only about 45 minutes north of the actual Four Corners. So the main part of the park, which is where the visitor center and the campground is in Utah. And then some of our outlying units, because we're kind of into these little scattered outlying communities here, are in Colorado. And Hovenweep is a Paiute word that means deserted valley. It was kind of given to the region by the famous photographer William Henry Jackson, who was working for the U.S. Geological Survey in the late 1800s. He'd heard about the ruins out here, which they were called at the time. We don't usually use the word ruin anymore. So he heard about the structures. He hired a Paiute guide, a local guide, to come out and take him out here. And then at some point, the guide said, you know, gestured to the area and said, Hovenweep. And so William Henry Jackson wrote that down and the name kind of stuck. And then we were created as a national monument in 1923. And they just kind of slapped the name on it. And here we are almost 100 years later.
Wow, I didn't realize it had been in the National Park Service for that long. That's amazing.
We're a pretty old site. I know, it's kind of surprising. A lot of the monuments in Utah are really old, are kind of some of the earlier ones. You know, we weren't quite in the Teddy Roosevelt frame. We were, Warren G. Harding was the president who designated ours. You know, the West was kind of being discovered and explored and settled, and the federal government, the presidents at the time, realized that a lot of these places needed to be protected and protected quick if they were going to keep them.
So you've mentioned the Paiute. Are they the indigenous people who occupied the area?
Yes, but they aren't the only ones. Mm-hmm. Sort of as with the entire United States, you know, there are so many different layers and different periods of occupation, different tribes that have some kind of connection with the landscape. And the same is true for Hovenweep, even though it's a really small, it's less than, you know, 1,000 square acres. We have quite a few tribes that call this place home. So the main kind of cultural group that we talk about here is the ancestral Puebloans. And those, kind of what the name sounds like, are the ancestors of the modern Pueblo peoples. And so we normally say that this is the culture, one of the cultural homelands of the Pueblo peoples, and a few others who also consider the ancestral Puebloans to be their ancestors. There's over 26, I think, affiliated tribes. But then we also have the Ute and the Paiute, a couple different bands of those tribes in the area. We're less than 5 miles away from the Navajo Reservation. So there's quite a few different cultural groups that have some kind of connection to this place.
I have been reading a book called The Guide to Prehistoric Astronomy in the Southwest, and it's talking primarily about these ancestral Puebloans. And boy, they had quite a range of homeland, and which makes sense why you say there's so many tribes that are associated with ancestral Puebloan, because of just the vast space, because they went all the way to like Chaco Canyon and I think Mesa Verde near you, right?
Yeah, there are. And so now there are, of course, several different national parks, monuments, recreation areas, and other federal agency sites that all protect some part of what has been left behind by the ancestral Puebloans. It's a really kind of complicated history, but it's amazing just how far spread this cultural group was. And we do kind of try to call it a cultural group because, like you said, there's so many people who have some kind of affiliation with it. Or consider themselves to be the descendants. And it wasn't just, you know, one clan, one place, one group of people. There was just so many that were under this really big umbrella.
I think the thing that fascinates me the most about the ancestral Puebloans, though, and this is why you and I are here talking today, is that everywhere they lived, everywhere they met together for ceremonies, they built these elaborate structures with astronomical alignments or possible, you know, using them for astronomical ceremonies. And so we know that these ancient Puebloans had a really strong connection to the night sky. And so I'm wondering what you can share with us about the archaeoastronomy, specifically there at Hovenweep.
Sure. And I mean, it's kind of like how much time do you have, you know? We have a lot of fantastic examples of archaeoastronomy here. So of course, astronomy, you know, the last chunk of that word is just the study of stars or the study of space, everything to do with the night sky or any of the celestial bodies. So even the sun and things like that too. Mm-hmm. And then archaeoastronomy just kind of adds that like ancient knowledge, that ancient astronomical knowledge. And so of course the word archaeoastronomy is just the study of that ancient knowledge of the night sky and the celestial bodies. And so we do have archaeologists basically who go in and use archaeology and their astronomy knowledge to kind of figure out what the people who lived here or in other places knew. So at Hovenweep, kind of like you said, of course, the structures we have here are similar to a lot of other structures you'll find in the Southwest, like at Chaco or at Mesa Verde. They're these lovely, big, thick stone towers and castles and houses. And of course, these are the names we put on them, but you know, that's what they look like, these big medieval castles. And a lot of these were built with different astronomical alignments in mind. And so we have a couple different examples of typical types of archaeoastronomy here. We have, I think, one of the classics, like Chaco has, where two of our buildings at the Cajon unit, which is one of our outlying units, they align like a giant sundial. And so the shadows they cast on each other mark different times of the year, including all the solstices and the equinoxes as well. So that's just a huge example of two completely separate structures with a huge courtyard in between them acting like one giant calendar. And then we have smaller examples in a lot of our other structures, the most famous of which was going to be Hovenweep Castle in the Square Tower group. There are little, we call portholes in the walls of the outer part of the castle here. And oftentimes those were used, they used to have beams in them for flooring, but then some of them were left open and there for light and ventilation. If you're, you know, living in a big stone room, you're going to want light and air to be able to come in. But the way that they're formed aligns them to, again, the solstices and the equinoxes. So we're all about solar here at Hovenweep. It's not so much the alignment of certain stars or the moon. It's our star. It's the sun. So those are aligned so that on sunset of the equinoxes and the solstices, light will enter them and then hit into different parts of the inner room, whether that's inner doorways or inner corners. And the main doorway of the castle itself also acts like that, too.
I just think it's so cool, the connection that they had with the sky, because, you know, we don't really build anything like that today. And I think that's a reflection of our disconnect from the sky. You know, we don't use calendars and clocks anymore where we rely personally on looking at the sky. And I think we've lost something in that. And so I just love that part about archaeoastronomy, that deep connection to what was happening around them in nature and above their heads. It's just so awesome.
Well, it's so funny because we, you know, our calendar is based on lunar cycles and it's based on our, you know, our orbit around the sun. But we're just so far removed from the process of that, right? Like it's already been established for so many centuries, but then we moved to paper and now to, you know, who even has a paper calendar anymore? It's all on your smartphone. But all of that, everything that you have on that supercomputer in your pocket all comes back to sky watchers, just like the ancestral Puebloans were.
Yeah. And I just kind of miss that we don't get that opportunity. I've created a little thing in my front yard where I have a little spot where I stand, and then I've created markers for where the sun rises on the solstices and equinoxes, just because I felt like, you know, just because we don't really do that as a society anymore, I want to.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. That's incredible. I would probably do that too, but I'm lucky. I live, you know, right next door to some of the most impressive ones in the area.
No kidding. Oh, and Hovenweep is also a certified International Dark Sky Park. And so tell us a little bit about that. How long have you guys been a certified park?
Sure. We've been certified for 8 years now. Let me do my math here. We were certified on July 1st of 2014. And we were the world's 17th International Dark Sky Park.
Nice. You know, what's funny is I live in Fountain Hills, Arizona, and we're the world's 17th International Dark Sky Community.
Oh, sisters. I love that. And I love that there's so many designations now. I think, you know, back in 2014, which is a little bit before my time at Hovenweep and honestly with the Park Service, but back at that point, they were still doing different tiers. And I think they were really just doing dark sky parks. And now there are so many designations you can get. And it's, you know, yes, of course, it's great to have that plaque that says Dark Sky Park, but really it's all the things behind it about staying dark, about keeping your dark sky certification. And that goes into the measuring darkness. You can actually measure darkness, which is crazy to me. And building those connections with your community to help them stay dark as well. If you're a park or if you're a community, you know, helping your neighborhood stay dark. And so the plaque is great, but it really just shows, you know, how much effort goes into maintaining your darkness.
Does Hovenweep offer nighttime programs?
We do. We're not offering as many as I think we'd like, but as we've said, we're kind of a remote national monument. We only get a around 35 to 40,000 people a year, and we're a small staff. So with all that in mind, we do nighttime astronomy programs typically in the late spring and then the fall, because that's when most of our visitation happens. We traditionally do about a 45-minute constellation tour and telescope viewing. So we actually have those lovely green laser pointers. I don't know if you've seen them before.
And I have one.
They're amazing. They're so fun. So you point out constellations with folks and you kind of chat about the night sky and your connections and all of that lovely stuff. And then it's more of an informal telescope viewing where you pull up the telescope and whatever is up, you know, we kind of take a look at. You know, Saturn's always a favorite. I like showing people what a star looks like just because it's, you know, it just looks like a brighter, more bigger version of what you see with your naked eye. But that kind of shows too how much you really can see without needing all of this expensive equipment.
Right. Absolutely. So I imagine because of your more remote location that it's easy to just look up and see the Milky Way. Am I right about that?
Yes. And of course, there's, you know, the best viewing times is going to be, you know, late summer, early fall is when the brightest part of the Milky Way is kind of highest in the sky. But any time of the year, as someone who lives here year round, the Milky Way is pretty easy to see as long as it's not a full moon or cloudy. And it gets cloudy here more often than you would think for a high desert park. But it's stunning. This was definitely, this was the first park where I had seen the Milky Way. I'm from Maryland originally, back on the East Coast. I lived in a rural part of Maryland, or at least what I thought was rural until I moved out here. And even then, just the, you know, you could only see like a handful of stars, maybe the Big Dipper. So Hovind Weap actually has a strong connection for me personally, because this was the first park that I started doing astronomy at. I'm one of the astronomy rangers here, and I continued that as a seasonal throughout several parks I worked at. And the first time I saw the Milky Way. So I try to bring all of that experience, all of those memories and strong emotions that I felt into my programs here, because it is, it's probably the first time a lot of these folks have seen the Milky Way.
Right. Because with light pollution, it's estimated that 80% of people on the planet can't see it anymore. And that's, to me, that's really heartbreaking.
It really is. And it's something that you don't even realize you're missing until you see it.
Right.
Like I said, like I had thought I had a good night sky where I grew up, and it never really dawned on me how much I was missing until I started learning about it and I saw it for myself. And then, you know, going back home and trying to explain to my parents who haven't been out to visit me, thank you, pandemic, you can't explain it to someone. It's hard to capture in film. I know people do, but you just to see it for yourself with your own eyes standing underneath it is an entirely different experience and one that everyone should have.
And then, you know, you mentioned that you're close to that Four Corners area, which I imagine is pretty dark up there too. I live in Arizona. I haven't made it up to the corner of Arizona yet, but I'm going to be there this fall. I'm going to come see you.
Yay! You totally should. That'd be amazing.
What can people expect when they visit Hovind Weap?
Ooh, it kind of depends on the season. But no matter what time of year you come, expect to be blown away by the architecture here. I think that's one of the comments we get the most often is people who visited several other ancestral Puebloan sites, and yet something is just different about Hovind Weap. I mean, that's why it was created as a national monument, because the architecture here was so unique. So expect some walking. Unfortunately, we aren't a driving park, and that's because everything here is so sensitive. It's all sensitive archaeological sites, and cultural sites, of course. Expect some walking. Expect it to be hot if you're going to come, you know, the warm 6 months out of the year, very hot, and potentially snow covered in the winter, which is just as magical. And please expect to stay late. We have a lovely 31 site campground that very, very, very rarely fills, which is rare in this day and age.
Right.
And it makes a wonderful viewing spot. You know, like right now it's August 4th when we're talking, and our campground had maybe 3 sites taken last night. And, you know, we get a little bit busier in the spring and the fall, but not much. So we're kind of a hidden gem, maybe not so hidden anymore after this podcast.
Yes. Oh, I'm definitely making my way up there. Yeah. I've been learning about it. And so I was like, oh my gosh, I want people to know about this place. It sounds so amazing. So where can people learn more about Hovind Weap online?
Sure. So we do, of course, have our lovely National Park Service website, which is nps.gov/HOVE, which is the first four letters of Hovenweep. Mm-hmm. And then we are also on Facebook. So just search Hovenweep National Monument. And if you haven't already yet, I highly recommend that you get the NPS app. It's a brand new app that came out earlier this year. It has access to all of the National Park Service sites, which there are currently over 400 and some. You can download information for offline viewing as well. So if you're coming out here, you'll probably have spotty service. You can get access to all the park information, including images, self-guided tours, fees, all of that wonderful stuff just through one app on the phone you already have in your pocket. So I highly recommend it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing about Hovenweep. And I really think that people need to make some time to, if they don't live in the Southwest, make your way to the Southwest. I mean, you can't go wrong as far as night skies go, but really engaging with these cultural places and how they took the night sky and brought it into their architecture. It's just absolutely remarkable and fascinating. And so I'm so happy that you joined us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I totally agree. I think, of course, it's one thing to go out into a natural place when it's dark and stand up and look at the night sky, but to come to a place that has, you know, at least hundreds, if not thousands of years of people doing the exact same thing that you were going to do, that's a different experience. It's a powerful one. So I hope that, yeah, people come out and join us and come into the visitor center and say hi to me, because I'm one of the few people who work here, so you'll probably see me.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Do you love the topic of archaeoastronomy? I love learning about how ancient cultures built structures and left petroglyphs that marked alignments with the cosmos. Whether they were marking solstices, equinoxes, the cardinal points, significant stars, or some other celestial feature, I love to learn about it. And if you do too, you'll want to check out a few of the past episodes. In episode 5, I chat with Luke Edens about cultural astronomy and some of his highly recommended archaeoastronomy sites in the United States. In episode 9, the well-known Dr. Anthony Aveni shares about his research in Maya archaeoastronomy. In fact, he founded this field of study in the United States. In episode 16, Josh Dury gives us a glimpse into the archaeoastronomy of Stonehenge in England, where he worked at the time of our recording. And all of my solstice and equinox episodes dig into ancient cultural astronomy. You can find links to these recommended episodes in the show notes or visit nightskytours.com/46. It's time for our tour across the night sky. Pause the podcast, gather everyone in your house, and I'll meet you outside under the stars. Before we hop across the sky to identify the beautiful summer constellations, let's start by taking a closer look at the famous Hercules constellation. You can find it by looking straight overhead, where you're going to see the bright summer triangle stars of Vega, Deneb, and Altair. And if you're unsure about how to locate the summer triangle, go back and listen to the star tour in episode 44 when you're done with this one. Okay, so you're looking straight overhead. Now shift your gaze toward the west a little way, where you're going to see a crooked box. These stars are not super bright, but if you don't live under terrible light pollution, then you should be able to spot them. You can try using a planisphere or a smartphone app to identify all the stars that make up this constellation. Hercules appears upside down in relation to all the other constellations around him. The ancient people saw Hercules as a man who was on bended knee with both arms raised up. One raised to one side and one to the other side. And his right foot appears to be standing on the head of Draco, a serpent-like dragon whose tail is between Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, or the Big and Little Dippers. The area of the sky where Hercules lies is filled with amazing celestial objects. It's home to numerous double stars, and 15 stars in Hercules are known to have planets. Astronomers detected a powerful astronomical explosion there in June of 2018 that they estimate was 10 to 100 times brighter than a normal supernova. And also in this region of the sky, there are globular clusters, planetary nebulae, and even what they call the Hercules Corona Borealis Great Wall, which is the largest known structure in the entire universe. In addition to the numerous celestial objects within its borders, Hercules has many tremendous myths associated with him, and they're all fascinating. He was one of the best-known heroes of Greek and Roman mythology, and according to legend, Hercules' father was Zeus, and his mother was Alcmene. Alcmene was the granddaughter of Perseus, who famously beheaded the snake-haired Gorgon, Medusa. But Hercules had enemies before he was even born. Zeus's wife, Hera, found out that her husband's mistress was pregnant and she flew into a rage. First, she used her supernatural powers to prevent him from becoming the ruler by ensuring that a more feeble baby boy would be granted rulership instead. After Hercules was born, she sent two snakes to kill him in his crib. But the infant was unusually strong and he was fearless, and he strangled the snakes before they had a chance to strangle him. When Hercules grew up, he married and he had two children. And Hera kept up her dirty tricks by casting a spell on him that made him temporarily insane. And in his insanity, he ended up killing his wife and children. And after the insanity faded, Hercules was heartbroken, and he felt tremendous guilt for what he had done. So he sought out Apollo, the god of truth and healing, and he begged to be punished for his actions. But Hera's vengefulness was no secret, and Apollo knew that Hercules should not be faulted. So he assigned to Hercules 12 heroic labors or tasks. And if he were to complete all 12 of them, he would be freed from his guilt and he would be granted immortality. He became known for these heroic labors and revered and even worshipped by mortals thereafter. Zeus commemorated him for these mighty acts by placing his constellation in the sky. All right, let's take a little trip across the Milky Way now. If you can't see the Milky Way, you're in the same boat as about 80% of the people on our planet. Our often careless use of artificial light at night creates light pollution that blots out our view of the stars and even our own galaxy. Start by finding Cassiopeia. Look directly toward the north, and then shift your eyes slightly toward the east, where you're going to find a sideways W. Cassiopeia sits right over the top of the Milky Way. Now look southward and slightly toward the west from Cassiopeia to find what looks like an upside down house, like the kind that a child would draw. That is Cepheus. And the bottom corner of it is in the stream of the Milky Way. Now continue toward the south to the super bright star of Deneb, which is in the constellation Cygnus. Cygnus is a swan. Can you see his wings outstretched to either side of this bright star? His neck is outstretched toward the south. Can you imagine the shape of a swan swimming through the stream of the Milky Way? Now keep going south from Cygnus to the constellation Aquila. It contains another bright star called Altair. Aquila is an eagle. And to me, this constellation looks like a flying hang glider suspended directly over the Milky Way. Aquila points directly towards Sagittarius. And although Sagittarius is known as a centaur, or a half man and half horse, the smaller asterism of the teapot is what we mostly see in our light-polluted skies today. And that teapot is just above the southern horizon right now. It looks like it has a pointy lid, and if your skies are dark enough, it will look like steam is rising from its spout, which is, of course, the Milky Way. So from Cassiopeia to Cepheus, to Cygnus, to Aquila, to Sagittarius, The Milky Way stretches all the way across the summer night sky from north to south. And now let's end by looking toward the eastern sky, where you're going to see a bright star, which is actually a planet, not a star. That is Saturn. Saturn is back in our night sky, and I'm very, very excited to see it. If you look at it with binoculars or through a backyard telescope, you will be able to see its rings. I never, ever get tired of looking at it. And I think it's one of the most beautiful and stunning celestial objects to look at from my telescope. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to things we've talked about in this episode, or visit nightskytourist.com/46. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tourist Podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tourist Podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.